Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On December 19th, 2008, during the last days of the Bush administration, the Bureau of Land Management held an auction in Utah to sell almost 150,000 acres of federal land to oil and gas companies. Today's guest, Tim DeChristopher, who was a University of Utah student at the time, didn't think protesting outside of the auction was enough. So he entered the auction hall and registered as bidder number 70. He successfully bid on 22,000 acres of land worth almost $2 million. Tim DeChristopher's act of civil disobedience led to the cancellation of the auction, which saved nearly 150,000 acres of pristine land from the oil and gas industry. But his nonviolent action landed him in prison. On July 26, 2011, Tim was sentenced to 2 years in federal prison, a $10,000 fine, and 3 years of supervised probation. Tim ended up serving 21 months in prison and is still on probation. He says he embraced nonviolence because it's the most effective thing people can do, and he believes the climate movement has seen a dramatic increase of civil disobedience, and it's building a new kind of power. So at this very critical time in history, what kind of activism is most effective? Tim DeChristopher's story is told in the documentary Bitter 70. Tim is an environmentalist, founder of Peaceful Uprising, an organization that uses nonviolent action to create a healthy world, and he's co-founder of the Climate Disobedience Center, an organization that engages in direct action. And Tim DeChristopher joins me in studio. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. We did a show about Bitter 70 when it came out. It's a great film, and I hope you can all see it. You still have a couple of months on probation, and as part of your sentencing, you cannot leave the country or get arrested.
Correct.
And I also understand that you spent 21 months in prison, and it further radicalized you in many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I saw on an intimate level how our government really operates, and so I think it deepened a lot of the things that I knew intellectually about a lot of social justice issues. It sort of humanized those issues for me because it was 2 years that I spent living with some of the most oppressed people in our society, people who are not only oppressed in their current situation, but by and large got into that situation because they were disenfranchised or disempowered in one way or another. So, yeah, I think it made me into more of a revolutionary and certainly made me into a prison abolitionist.
There's a great story about this in Rhode Island Future. You live in Rhode Island now?
Yes.
And you told this reporter, Steve Alquist, about a man you met in jail named Alejandro, and he was serving time for drug smuggling. Tell us about him and then how his story affected you.
Yeah, well, that story was actually one that I used in a sermon that I gave at the Providence Unitarian Church. So Steve, the reporter, was there for that sermon. But Alejandro was an inmate who came in a little after I did and was there for transporting drugs and watching his experience in the visiting room with his family was one of the things that made me really understand structural evil. Because, you know, the first time his family showed up, he's got about a 4-year-old son and then a baby. And, then they had a wonderful visit all day long. And then at the end of the day, when it was time for the visitors to leave, his 4-year-old son couldn't understand why his father couldn't go with him and was just clinging to his father and crying, and just refused to leave basically. And the mother was trying to kind of drag the kid away, but she was like carrying the baby at the same time. And it was an extremely emotional scene where the father was crying, the mother was crying. All of us inmates that were in the room were crying or choking back tears. And the guard finally had to just kind of grab the kid with the mother and drag him all the way across the room and out the door. Alejandro kind of broke down sobbing at that point, And everybody in the room was crying except for the guard, who just had no emotional reaction whatsoever. And so that got me thinking about what it would take to do that kind of job every day, the job of literally tearing families apart and that work of intergenerational violence against a child who couldn't possibly understand what's going on. And I realized that what it would take is to dehumanize the inmates, that the only way you could tolerate doing that kind of work is to start seeing the inmates as less than yourself, or seeing their children as somehow different than your own children. Mm-hmm. And for me, that kind of dehumanization, that denial of the inherent worth and dignity of another person, that denial of the spark of divinity that I think is in all of us, to me, that's fundamentally what evil is. But if the only way that somebody can do their job day after day is to do that, then that's not, you know, personal evil. That's a structural, systemic kind of evil. And I saw that in the way that the guards kind of spiraled into dehumanizing inmates. And it was so commonplace that I kind of saw it as a kind of programming. And in order to tolerate the dehumanization that we were constantly subjected to, I started to just see the guards as like robots, which helped, you know, to be able to deal with the disrespect and that sort of thing. And it wasn't until much later that I finally realized that my coping mechanism was to just see the guards as these machines and not take anything personally, because I didn't actually see them as people. And so I saw that same systemic evil, in which people can only operate in that system by dehumanizing those around us, had impacted me just as strongly as it had impacted the guards. And I was dehumanizing them in return.
You were sentenced to 2 years in a federal prison. Where were you?
Well, I was actually in five different institutions over those 2 years. The bulk of my time was split between a federal prison in Eastern California in Herlong, and then I got transferred to another federal prison in Littleton, Colorado.
What was the racial makeup in those prisons?
Both of those were kind of balanced about of like one third Hispanic, one third African American, and one third white, with a handful of Asian and Native Americans sprinkled in there as well.
Did you know much about prisons and the prison industry before you were sentenced?
Yeah, a bit. I mean, I had read The New Jim Crow when it came out, so you know, I was aware of that, but it was still kind of on the intellectual level, you know, and I'd taken it seriously. Like, the statistics in The New Jim Crow are shocking. But I think they were still statistics for me. Mm. And so my time inside really humanized and personalized what I knew in my head, I guess.
And did you talk to other prisoners about why you were there, their stories, your opinions of the guards? Did you have conversations about that?
Oh, yeah, all the time. I mean, we had lots of time, so we had lots of conversations. So, you know, being there as a political prisoner, I got kind of an automatic level of respect for that, because everyone who's in our federal prison system hates our federal government, so because they see how it works. So being there as someone who was resisting the government, resisting the BLM, and standing up to them and taking my case to trial, that gave me an automatic level of respect. And so people were certainly interested in that. It wasn't until I got sent to isolation for a sort of ridiculous cause, and then my activist community on the outside had to mobilize and barrage the Bureau of Prisons with phone calls in order to get me sent back to the general population, that I think a lot of the inmates around me kind of internalized what it meant to be an activist in a different way, or understood it in a different way. You know, they knew that I was an activist and that I was there as a political prisoner. But after they saw what happened with that whole situation, their reaction was like, kind of like, wait a minute, we can fight back against these people? Like, wait a minute, we can, like, oh, activism is how people outside of that power structure exercise their own power by organizing together. And so that I saw that click for people in a different way. And then people started coming to me with all kinds of issues. Hmm. And they were like, so here's what's going on with our medical care in here. How can we bring more attention to this? And here's what's going on with our education system. And, you know, we haven't had a teacher in here for almost a year. How can we do something about this? So, you know, after I got out of isolation, then I kind of became more of an activist in prison, with people bringing more issues to me. And then a couple weeks after that is when they said, we're transferring you to Colorado.
Wow. Are you in touch still with some of these prisoners?
No. I mean, part of my probation is that I'm not allowed to have any contact with convicted felons. So that means that I'm not allowed to write letters or anything like that, which is, I think, part of how they kind of create a separate class of folks that, you know, particularly for people who have been incarcerated for a long time, who have 10, 20, 30-year sentences, you know, when they come out and they're reintegrating into society, they're literally not allowed to talk to anyone who has been through that experience before. They're not allowed to have contact with people who could help them make sense of their situation.
And is that just for probation? So come April, can you reconnect with people that you met behind bars?
Yes.
Okay. So that's interesting. I have not heard that before. I mean, you often hear about how difficult it is to get a job, how difficult it is to find housing. But I haven't heard that you cannot be, if you're on probation, that you cannot be in contact with a convicted felon.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, people can get special permission if they have a family member, that sort of thing. You know, but particularly when a whole community is criminalized and you know, police really focus on a certain community that's impoverished and has a lot of people being rounded up and sent to prison from that community, it makes it extremely difficult for people to not violate probation, and kind of means that, you know, anytime they want to find a reason why somebody violated probation, they can often do it.
Today's guest, climate activist Tim DeChristopher, was sentenced to 2 years in jail for outbidding oil and gas executives during an auction to lease oil and gas drilling rights on pristine public lands in Utah. His nonviolent act led to the cancellation of the auction, which saved nearly 150,000 acres from fossil fuel development. Tim was, he served 21 months in prison, and he is still on probation. And if you have any questions for Tim about his time behind bars and how that now has shaped his climate activism, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. Tim says he embraced nonviolence because it's the most effective thing people can do. And he believes the climate movement has seen a drastic increase of civil disobedience and is building a new kind of power. So what kind of activism is most effective? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Tim has a number of speaking engagements coming up around the Bay Area. Tonight at 6:30, he'll be speaking at Climate One at the Commonwealth Club, 555 Post Street. Tomorrow night, he'll be speaking at the Unitarian Universalist of San Mateo, 7 o'clock. Thursday, he's got an event of the Star King School for the Ministry in Berkeley. And then he's got many more events, which I'll tell you about more during the show. But you can find his events at yourcallradio.org. So I noticed on your Twitter account, it says you're an activist working for fossil fuel and prison abolition. Mm-hmm. What does that mean to you?
Well, you know, I think I first made sense of it actually through the lens of prison abolition. And after kind of making sense of my experience in prison, as I said, I realized that this was a systemic evil and that basically prison was always evil. As an institution and as a system, and that it was never going to be an actual justice system, that it was never going to be healing either to the individuals involved or to society in general. And so to me, prison abolition means that that our current prison system is never going to become an actual justice system, that we need to build a justice system from the ground up, with its own institutions and its own practices that are actually in line with our values and what we want to see for our society, and that our current prison system actually needs to be abolished. After understanding that and kind of owning that that analysis and being willing to articulate that for myself, I started to look at the other work that I did around climate change and fossil fuels. And you know, I thought about the constant critique that we get as climate activists who are opposing fossil fuels, which is that, oh, but society needs energy, you know. And I realized that the same dynamic was at play with fossil fuels, in which our current energy system and the fossil fuel industry is never going to be the kind of just energy system that we need. That we need to build the energy system that meets our needs in a way that's actually in line with our societal values. We need to build that from the ground up, and we're certainly seeing the beginnings of that now with a clean energy economy that is emerging, and it's not coming from the old energy system. It's not the old energy corporations and fossil fuel companies that are shifting and beginning to build the new system. It's developing on its own, despite the power of the fossil fuel industry. So kind of translating that understanding from prison abolition made me realize that the position that I actually take in regards to climate change is actually a fossil fuel abolitionist, acknowledging that we need to abolish the fossil fuel industry and build the clean energy economy and actual energy systems that meet our needs in a healthy way. We need to build that from the ground up, rather than pretending that things can be transformed.
Let's take a few callers before we go to break. Again, I'm speaking with Tim DeChristopher. He was sentenced to 2 years in jail for outbidding oil and gas executives during an auction to lease oil and gas drilling rights on pristine public lands in Utah. He spent 21 months behind bars and has a few more months of probation. And I hope you can see the documentary Bitter 70. It does a great job of giving Tim a voice, but also explaining how these auctions work. And we'll definitely talk about that in just a couple minutes. Let's hear from Daniel in Berkeley. Hi, Daniel. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I just really wanted to express my sincere gratitude to Tim for what he's done and the intervention he's made. I can't underscore how important I think it is. One thing that strikes me listening to you today is what I've learned, and I thought I knew a lot about this already, but what I've learned about the racialization of incarceration in the United States and how pervasive and how its own reproduction seems built into the system of parole, I guess you would say. The question that comes from that for me is just thinking about your own activism, how you might in the future be relating your climate change activism and how that might speak to the kind of economy of incarceration. And I'm sorry if you've already spoken to this a little bit. I came in a little bit late to the program. But thank you again very much.
Yeah, thanks for that question, and it's something that I've been trying to make more sense of, and something that I felt for a while that on a deep level that there's a connection between our fight against mass incarceration and our fight against climate change. So I've tried to get better at articulating that, and a lot of what I've seen that it comes down to is a perspective that certain kinds of people in our society are disposable or expendable, and I think that expendability of people is what allows us to tolerate mass incarceration, and the same thing that allows us to tolerate an everyday energy economy that is destroying large regions of the world right now, that is making places unlivable, that is making homes go underwater, that is exacerbating storms and droughts and food shortages and all those things. We know that there's a real cost in terms of human lives to the energy economy that we have today, and the only way that we can kind of rationalize that to ourselves, I think, is on some level to view the people whose homes right now are going underwater as expendable, to view the future generations that are going to suffer extreme impacts as somehow expendable. And to me, that's the same attitude that is allowing us to send hundreds of thousands of people to prison every year at unprecedented levels, primarily in order for the profits of the private prison industry and a lot of the other industries that profit from prisons, and to sort of soak up the excess labor in a society that has outsourced a lot of our manufacturing or turned it over to mechanized production. We sort of just would rather just kind of sweep people away into prison rather than dealing with the human impacts of the economy that we have.
Thank you so much for asking that question, Daniel. I also wonder, how did the 21 months you spent behind bars, how did that affect your views on environmental racism? Because what you're just talking about right now makes me think about the marginalized communities, mostly communities of color, that are living, for example, near Chevron, or people in the Bayview, people who are breathing unhealthy air, who don't have clean water. Think about the people in Flint, Michigan, for example.
Yeah. I think the challenge of the climate movement has been shifting over the past 5-6 years to be as much about how we deal with the impacts of what is now largely inevitable than how to kind of keep everything the same. Like that goal of preventing harm is now in the rearview mirror. Like we've passed that point. So part of the question becomes, how do we deal with these impacts? And a key turning point for that was 2009, when the chances for a climate bill failed in a Democratic Congress, and Copenhagen was a massive failure, and kind of the years of effort by the big green organizations to appease those in power, and kind of create a cleaner, greener version of the world that we have now. Although those efforts failed catastrophically with that centrist theory of change. And so at that point, it became clear that places like Bangladesh were going to go underwater. And then when it became obvious that the land was going to go underwater, the question became, what will become of the people who live on that land, the 160 million Bangladeshis, about half of whom live at less than 10 meters above sea level? And that wasn't a question that we talked about publicly, because we were told that we weren't supposed to talk about adaptation because it would distract from mitigation efforts around climate change. And we were supposed to be hopeful and positive and not talk about this massive damage that we're now on track for. And so what happened was, after the wake of that, like in 2010, 2011, rather quietly, India built a border fence all the way around Bangladesh, a 1,790-mile partially electrified fence. And so in the absence of a public discourse about how to deal with these consequences in a humane way that is in line with our values, we sort of had a quiet, subtle default policy that says, we're going to keep those people right where they're at so that they don't inconvenience the rest of us. So partially because of the deep injustices that we have throughout our society and the history of white supremacy and colonization and things like that, I think the scariest thing about climate change is that our default response is genocidal. That we would rather condemn millions and millions of people to their deaths than allow them to escape and inconvenience the rest of us. Which is why dealing with the real impacts of climate change mean dealing with all of these other structural injustices in our society, because climate change is not just an environmental impact. It's not just a physical or scientific kind of impact. It's an environmental trigger on all of the other social tensions that we already have in our society. So those have to be addressed at the same time.
Tim DeChristopher is a climate justice activist. He is also working for prison abolition. He spent 21 months in prison after he was sentenced to 2 years for outbidding oil and gas execs during an auction to lease oil and gas drilling rights on pristine lands in Utah. And Tim will be speaking tonight at the Commonwealth Club's Climate One program. It's at 6:30, 555 Post in San Francisco. He's also speaking on Saturday at a special event for the Unitarian Universalist Social Justice Council from 6 to 9 p.m. That's 1187 Franklin in San Francisco. You can find more at our website, yourcallradio.org, or at timdechristopher.org. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on Your Call. On the phone, by sending an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or by going to yourcallradio.org, the website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by telephone, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about cities that are investing in worker co-ops to fight inequality and create quality jobs. New York has invested $1.2 million in co-ops, and it's set to double that this year. And here in California, Oakland is exploring ways it can cultivate more co-ops. So how are worker co-ops combating inequality? That's tomorrow. On Thursday, we'll talk about how we can preserve the arts and culture in the Bay Area, which is home to some of the most expensive cities in the country. And Friday, it is our media roundtable. Today, I am joined by climate activist Tim DeChristopher. We did a show about the documentary Bitter 70, which tells Tim's story. And it's an amazing story. He was sentenced to 2 years in jail because he went to an auction and outbid oil and gas executives during an auction to lease oil and gas drilling rights on pristine public lands. His nonviolent act led to the cancellation of the auction, which saved about 150,000 acres from fossil fuel development. He ended up serving 21 months in prison, and he's still on probation. Tim is a founder of Peaceful Uprising and co-founder of the Climate Disobedience Center, an organization that engages in direct action. He's got a number of events coming up over the next couple of days. You can find information at his website, timdechristopher.org. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Arian in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call. I spent a decade researching prisoner reentry, and my dissertation, which is 3 volumes, is being censored on Google. And I just want to mention that because I think we need to become more strategic on how we understand the role of the media and what we're up against. What I find so striking about this conversation is how it underscores not only Americans' proclivity to violence and environmental desecration, but the necessity of making these kind of linkages, and some of the linkages that haven't been articulated yet, but which your guest is living out, and that's what I really love about this conversation, is how he's showing how bringing a voice to something that's been silenced or something that's been demonized and then can be commodified or taken advantage of, like people of color, such that our economic system seems to be justified due to certain people having value, certain people not. We need to see how, like, the auctions of slaves, the auction of pristine forests, or how slaves were, like, incarcerated community, and then they were released at the end of the Civil War, and then they were arrested for vagrancy and homelessness, how these are all repeating things that didn't start recently with the gluttony over the prison system in the last 40 years related to drugs. It's just being used differently.
Well, Arian, thank you for raising these points. So talking about auctioning off land, I'm guessing that a lot of us who live in cities don't understand how this process works. You often hear about this. And when we go back to what happened on December 19th, 2008, when the Bureau of Land Management held an auction in Utah to auction off 150,000 acres of federal land to oil and gas companies. So is it true that they were basically privatizing the land and this was happening without public knowledge? I mean, how common is this?
Well, they weren't exactly privatizing the land. But, you know, the word that Arian used that jumped out at me was commodification, that we are both commodifying people and commodifying natural resources. And I do think that's a really appropriate way to talk about this, you know, because it does have roots in the very structure of a capitalist system that tries to commodify everything. And so they weren't exactly privatizing the land. They were auctioning off the right to drill for oil and gas. And so it sort of remains in the hands of the government, but they allow private companies to extract the value out of it. So they commodified what can be extracted from the land itself. And that system certainly continues to this day, but there are more and more climate organizations that are actually paying attention to that system now. And I was part of a big coalition of groups last fall that launched the Keep It in the Ground campaign that called for an end to fossil fuel leasing on public lands, which Obama has the power to do through an executive order. Some of the biggest mainstream groups like the NRDC and the ones with the best access to the White House, they refused to sign on to that campaign because they said it was too radical and too extreme. It was a couple months after we launched that campaign that Senator Jeff Merkley and Bernie Sanders introduced a Senate bill called the Keep It in the Ground Act mm-hmm. that would actually do exactly what we were looking for of ending fossil fuel leasing on public lands. And 2 months after that, just last week, Obama actually announced an executive order that put a moratorium on coal leasing on federal lands. So it's it was a bold and radical ask that is actually gaining a surprising amount of traction.
What is the status on the Sanders bill?
It's the same status of everything else worth doing in Congress, which is that it's not going anywhere right now. Yeah.
So in Bitter 70, it was fascinating to watch this process unfold. So you basically entered the auction hall and you registered as Bitter 70. And the lands come up for bid, and then these oil and gas executives put up their number and bid. That's just how it works. And so you bid on 22,000 acres of land worth almost $2 million. And when it came time to write the check, you clearly weren't going to do that. And so talk about that process and what those of us who aren't familiar with this, you know, what do we need to know about how this works?
Well, they have a quarterly auction in every BLM region. So basically the way the process works is that the oil and gas industry nominates parcels that they want to be able to drill. And the BLM is supposed to do some due diligence to see if those would be appropriate for oil and gas development. That was certainly not happening during the Bush administration. There's a little bit more of it happening now. But one of the factors that they have never really considered is climate change in that oil and gas development and what it would take for us to get on track for a sane climate future, including, you know, the goals that Obama says that he wants to meet of keeping climate change under 2 degrees. The actual energy development policy has nothing to do with those goals. So they have these quarterly auctions. The one that I went to was just in the BLM office in Salt Lake City, and I just walked right in and was intending to cause some kind of disruption, to stand in the way of it, and you know thought that would be giving a speech and getting dragged out by security and that sort of thing. And when I walked in, they said, "Would you like to be a bidder?" And I said, "Well, yes, I would," and got signed up, used my real name, all that kind of stuff, and they just handed me a bid card. And so inside it was, you know, kind of like what you see on TV as like a cattle auction kind of thing, like a guy in a hat that was talking really fast and says, oh, I got $250 over there. Do I have $275? I got $3. So, you know, all I had to do was just raise the bid card. The shocking thing was just how cheap those parcels were going. There were parcels that I won for $2.25 an acre. And a lot of them were going for $10 or $12 an acre. And so before I actually started winning parcels, I was just driving up the price. And I would wait for it to go down to one bidder where it was going once, going twice, and then I'd jump in and drive it up for a while. And there were ones that I drove up from $15 an acre to $240 an acre, and the industry still realized, you know, still thought it was valuable at that price. They were still bidding on it. So it was clear that that these parcels were sort of just being handed over to the industry for a fraction of what everybody involved knows that they're worth.
And this is beautiful land. I mean, images are shown in the film, but some of the parcels are adjacent to Canyonlands National Park, for example, the beautiful mm-hmm. Red Rocks.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's incredible lands, you know, but I think that's what we're seeing with fossil fuel development across the country and really around the world, you know, that, 8-10 years ago, there was a lot of talk about peak oil, and us getting to the point where we couldn't keep extracting enough light, sweet, easy to access crude oil, in order to meet our demands. And nobody kind of knew what would happen once we passed that point of peak oil. And it turns out that what happened when we passed that point of peak oil is that we just got more desperate. And we were just willing to destroy more pristine places. We were willing to go to greater extremes with deep water oil drilling in the Gulf and trying to drill in the Arctic. In deep water offshore drilling up there, we were willing to frack people's backyards across the country. We were willing to destroy water sources. We're willing to frack on a fucking fault line in California, which is insane. We kind of hit the bottom of the barrel and just kept going with more desperation in terms of fossil fuels. It's really just a new level of insanity that we're at now.
Tim DeChristopher is a climate justice activist, and he's in the Bay Area. He'll be speaking at a number of events. You can find them at timdechristopher.org. You can join us at 866-798-8255 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We have a couple of emails about what happened with this auction. So it was canceled, which saved 150,000 acres from fossil fuel development. Was that temporary, or what's happening on that land now?
Well, it was temporary. And once that auction was rescinded, those lands kind of went into the normal limbo that most of our public lands are in this country, in which they're not really being protected, but they're not actively being developed right now. And so it was in that limbo for a while. But the Bureau of Land Management and the Department of the Interior did start to reconsider the way that they were doing that leasing program. And in particular in that Moab region. So they began the process back then that is now culminating in new master leasing plans for these Bureau of Land Management districts that actually take a lot of those parcels off the table and make them permanently off limits for drilling.
And again, you were sentenced to 2 years in prison. We have a caller who wants to talk about the sentencing. Let's hear from Mark in Berkeley. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you very much. Mr. DeChristopher, I just wanted to thank you. The day that you did your action really made my day, and I was just, you know, happy the whole day. Of course, I was really shocked when I heard of the sentence, and so thank you for that also. But, you know, I wanted to say that... I can't believe that they gave you this harsh sentence for what essentially was kind of a hoax. I mean, it was a victimless crime. There was some schedules that had to be rescheduled, you know, and like you say, the land ended up more or less getting back on the auction block. I'm wondering, do you think that this is a ramping up against protest? I mean, I know that at the School of the Americas, they were putting priests and nuns in jail for 6 months. Or do you think this is the prison industry who's running out of petty pot smokers to lock up, since we all know that in this country, money is basically what runs everything? I'll take your answer on the air. Thank you.
So my sentencing was an interesting insight into what the government is actually afraid of. You know, my sentencing judge hadn't had much of a legal career. He was a political ideologue. He had worked as the chief of staff to Senator Orrin Hatch and was appointed directly to the bench from Senator Hatch's office because of his influence with the Judiciary Committee. And he kind of made it clear where he stood politically. And the interesting thing he said in my sentencing hearing was that my actual action wasn't that big of a deal, but the fact that I'd been speaking out against the government at that point for 2.5 years and encouraging other people to engage in civil disobedience was why he felt like I needed that strong of a sentence. And what he said was, from what he knew about that case, if it hadn't have been for my continuing trail of public statements, I wouldn't have been prosecuted in the first place. So it's they made it clear that the government is very scared of words, actually. They're scared of nonviolent action. They're scared of their legitimacy being undermined by moral activists, you know, which is why I feel like nonviolent action is more effective than violent resistance. And, you know, I think part of why the government doesn't seem to be particularly concerned with the Bundy Clan folks that are out there on the refuge in Oregon, because a violent resistance to the United States government is not actually a threat to them, because the United States government is the greatest force of violence in the history of violence. That's their game. They play it better than anybody. And so if you want to play their game on their turf, they're not very scared of that. But when we start to undermine their moral legitimacy, I think that's when they get uncomfortable.
And the oil executives were not happy about this at all. Right. And the oil executives give money to politicians. You bid on at this auction under the remaining days of the Bush administration, but you were sentenced under the Obama administration. And you actually faced up to 10 years in prison and $750,000 in fines. Your lawyer, Patrick Shea, is a former BLM director under Clinton. And if I remember correctly, in the film, he was just outraged at these charges. He was shocked by it all. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. He was certainly outraged by it, and has been speaking out about it still to this day. And, you know, he was somebody whose political education kind of began when he worked on the Church Commission under Senator Frank Church of investigating COINTELPRO and the way that the FBI infiltrated and tried to destroy social movements in the 60s and 70s. He was a lead investigator on that. And so that gave him an insight to the lengths that the government is willing to go to disempower communities and to disrupt social movements. So I think he took the prosecution of me very seriously from the very beginning, because he saw he saw how threatened the government is by nonviolent social movements, and the lengths that they're willing to go to destroy them.
And he represented you pro bono.
Yes.
Well, thank you for the call. Thank you for the email. Let's go next to Richard in San Francisco. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the show. Oh, dropped Richard. Let's hear from, sorry about that, Timothy in Pacifica. Hi, Timothy.
Yes, hello. First of all, I really want to extend my gratitude and thanks for the sacrifice you made. It's beyond calculation in my mind. But I'm calling specifically to discuss how we on a local level can follow through on what inspired my call when I tuned in, you know, around 10:30 was the tragedy of, you know, such sort of gratuitous selfishness on all our parts and ignoring the consequences for, of course, it's no longer going to be just third world countries and peoples, but it's going to be the, you know, people in every walk of life. But somehow, we've developed such a insular consciousness and culture, you know, fueled by great wealth and power in this country, that I think a lot of my fellow activists and people who have been doing this for decades, you know, frankly, as I have tried to, are looking for how to raise that consciousness without turning people off, where they feel shamed and they feel like they have to retreat from even thinking about it, because when you look at it very long, it's so disheartening and so, you know, fraught with guilt on all of our parts that people just sort of turn away.
Yeah.
And if you could comment on that, that'd be brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, I really like the way that you framed that around the work of awakening consciousness and arousing consciousness in our communities, which to me is the critical point about civil disobedience. And it's a big part of the reason that I helped start the Climate Disobedience Center with some other folks that are trying to encourage more principled civil disobedience in the climate movement. And we were all up in Seattle last week for the trial of the Delta Five, who were five activists that blockaded an oil train back in 2014. And they were the first folks in the country in the climate movement that were able to use the necessity defense, the argument that they acted out of necessity to prevent greater harm, and the first ones to present a climate case around that in a courtroom. And they were able to have climate scientists on the stand and oil safety experts on the stand and a BNSF whistleblower, and they all spoke in their own defense about what drove them to take this action. And their defense ended up being shut down towards the end of the trial by the judge after they'd presented all this evidence. But the interesting thing about that was afterwards, half the jury stuck around and talked to the defendants after the trial was over and thanked them basically for a political awakening that those jury members had kind of been forced into. You know, they were just random people who were selected for jury duty that week and had to sit there for 4 or 5 days and listen to all this testimony. And they said, you know, I never really understood all this stuff or thought about this stuff very much. But, you know, we don't want to see Washington become a fossil fuel corridor. And three of them signed up with the lead defendant to show up at our next lobby day. Two of them signed up with the Climate Disobedience Center.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty remarkable.
What do they want to work on?
Well, they want to work on preventing the fossil fuel export facilities off the coast of Washington. Mm-hmm. But they also want to help us train future defendants who are going on trial for these kind of cases. Mm-hmm. But I feel like the main way that that they were aroused out of kind of their everyday lethargic apathy of you know, being consumers in our society was through the power of the vulnerability of the activists that stood in the way of that train and were willing to accept the consequences of the criminal justice system for doing that. And to me, that's really what the tool of civil disobedience is that it taps into a power of vulnerability. And through our own vulnerability, we rattle people out of their everyday routine because it's so shocking to see someone putting themselves in a vulnerable position, you know, in a society that really only understands power in the context of domination and control and security. For someone to step into a kind of power that comes from insecurity and vulnerability, I think is shocking enough that it rattles people and arouses their conscience in a new way.
Hmm. That's a great story. We have just about a minute left, and we're getting a lot of emails. Just in terms of what strategies do you think are most successful at this critical time in history when it comes to raising awareness about what we're actually facing and then ensuring that we take a complete 180 when it comes to what we're doing today?
To me, it comes down to to strategies that are authentic, in which people can reveal their true selves. I think that's where we're most powerful at getting through to one another. And you know, part of the problem with the trial this week, that last week that we were pushing back against, was the notion that kind of tactics or strategies exist in a vacuum, isolated from one another. I think they have to be integrated. They have to support one another, and we have to be flexible in the way that we shift from one to the other, because especially in doing the work of climate justice, we have very real opponents, and our opponents in this are the richest and most powerful industry in the world, you know, which means that they're studying our tactics just as well as we are. And we might find something that's successful and that makes some progress, and our opponents are going to learn from it just as well as we learn from it. So we're going to have to adapt and be flexible and try new things and be creative, you know, I think, which is why we need more people to be empowered to just take their own initiative in the climate movement, not wait for big organizations and NGOs to tell them what to do, but to just go out and try to challenge that existing power structure in anywhere that we can, knowing that there's a big movement ready to get behind anybody who starts to get some momentum.
Tim DeChristopher has been our guest today. He spent 11 months in prison after he outbid oil and gas executives during an auction to lease oil and gas drilling rights on public lands in Utah. His story is told in the documentary Bitter 70. Tim is speaking tonight at Climate One at 630 555 Post in San Francisco, and on Saturday at a special event for the Unitarian Universalist Social Justice Council from 6 to 9 p.m., 1187 Franklin in San Francisco. You can find more on his speaking events at yourcallradio.org. Tim DeChristopher, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll discuss cities investing in worker co-ops to fight inequality and create quality jobs. Worker co-ops are typically governed by employees, and the decision-making is democratic. New York invested $1.2 million in co-ops and is set to double that this year. Here in California, Oakland is exploring ways it can cultivate more co-ops. So how are worker co-ops combating inequality? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.